John Adams did not write the American Declaration of Independence. That credit goes to his colleague, lifelong friend, and sometime nemesis, Thomas Jefferson. Adams merely made it happen when it did, and that may have made all the difference. We rightly honor all the heroes of the American Revolution, though we also gloss over their warts, but the story of John Adams is one of almost unimaginable heroism. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about the life and times of John Adams and the remarkable role he played in American history. Our guest is author and historian David McCullough. His biography, John Adams, won the Pulitzer Prize, the American Academy of Diplomacy Award, and the Christopher Award, and the Revolutionary Roundtable Award, was Time Magazine's Best Nonfiction Book of the Year, and also the New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice. John Adams was a national bestseller in hardcover when it was published last year, and it was recently republished in paperback by Touchstone Books. As we talk with David McCullough, you are invited into the conversation. Questions on the topic are welcome. All you need to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. And we can also take email questions, talk@will.uiuc.edu, anytime during this hour. Let me mention a bit more about our guest, David McCullough. He is the author of six other highly acclaimed works of history: The Johnstown Flood, The Great Bridge, The Path Between the Seas, Mornings on Horseback, Brave Companions, and Truman, which also won the Pulitzer Prize, and all of his books remain in print. He has twice won both the National Book Award and the Francis Parkman Prize. He's been honored by the National Book Foundation Distinguished Contribution to American Letters Award, the National Humanities Medal, the St. Louis Literary Award, the Carl Sandburg Award, and the New York Public Library's Literary Lion Award. He's past president of the Society of American Historians and has been elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's been an editor, essayist, lecturer, and is one of the few private citizens ever asked to speak before a joint session of Congress. David McCullough has also been the host of many public television series, including Smithsonian World and The American Experience, and the narrator of many documentaries, including The Civil War. He's been called a master of the art of narrative history, and his books, including the book John Adams, certainly testify to that. And he joins us this morning by telephone. David McCullough, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Thank you so much for granting us your time.
I'm delighted to be with you.
It might seem like a silly question, given the compelling story there is to tell in the life of John Adams, but I am curious. Why did you choose him as a subject as opposed to others you might have chosen?
I started out with the idea of doing a dual biography of Jefferson and Adams. I was fascinated by the life of Jefferson, have been fascinated with Jefferson since I was in high school, and felt I knew a good deal about it. I was also very impressed, intrigued, as so many people are, by the fact that Jefferson and Adams incredibly, died on the same day, and that it wasn't just any old day, it was their day of days, the 4th of July, 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And so I thought it would be interesting to see how these two very different men, who had such effect on the history of our country, how their paths of their lives crisscrossed, intertwined, and moved from, as you suggested in your introduction, from being fellow patriots, close friends, to becoming rivals, really almost enemies, for quite some time, and then eventually, after reconciliation, remain friends again until their dying day. And my concern was that Jefferson, with his aura, his fame, his glamour as a tall, somewhat mysterious Virginian, mysterious in that he never really revealed much about his private or personal life, would be forever upstaging a short, cranky John Adams from Massachusetts. And it was a lesson for me in some ways that we often worry about the wrong things, because it was very soon after I got into the Adam's material, the great collection of letters and diaries that have survived at the Massachusetts Historical Society, and began to read what Adams himself really had to say and what kind of a human being he was, that in fact Adams interested me more than Jefferson. And also because Adams is so forthcoming about his life, his feelings, his aspirations, disappointments, and so forth, and especially, I think, too, his deep, abiding affection for his wife, the real love story of their lives, that I knew that that's the book I wanted to write. I wanted to write about Adams. So it sort of happened to me, and once I realized that my initial idea wasn't the way to do it, that just to concentrate on Adams, wherein, of course, I would still have the chance to tell the story of Adams and Jefferson, once I decided that, the book almost seemed to write itself.
Yeah. Well, it's a marvelous read, and it gives so much insight into the events and the very personal impact those events had on people and the very powerful impact of individuals on those events. I sometimes think Americans have an idea that our independence was inevitable, that we are somehow living out our destiny. But as I read the stories in your book, I often find myself wondering at how many close calls there were.
Well, the more I read about it, the more I know about it, and I'm working on a book now about the Revolution, the more impressed I am, the more I feel that it really was a miracle that it happened at all. A miracle that we declared independence, a miracle that we won the war, and a miracle that the government under the new Constitution survived those first very precarious years when Washington was president and succeeded by Adams. I also think many people have the impression that all these founders were great friends and that they just got along famously with each other, which of course is not the case. And none of them was a god or a saint, heaven knows. They all had their failings and their imperfections. They're human beings, What is so essential to appreciating, respecting what happened, is that human beings, with their flaws and failings, could rise to the occasion and do what they did. That's the story. And that they weren't just like we are, because they couldn't be just like we are, because they lived in such a vastly different time. And I had never worked in the 18th century. I'd never written about the 18th century until this project. And for me, in many ways, that was one of the most appealing aspects of the whole 6 years that it took to write the book.
Yeah.
To go back into that really amazing time of our founding.
What seems so clear in the words of John Adams is that he was poignantly aware of the significance of his time, that this, he felt, was a moment that he had to act, that this was the moment to push for American independence.
Yes, I think that by and large they all knew that. They had a sense that they were actors in a great drama of immense historic importance, and that they each individually and collectively had to rise to the occasion, to play their parts well. And this theme of the stage of history, of the drama of history, of actors in noble parts and so forth, comes through in much of what they wrote themselves at the time. So that, and Adams says at one point, "I'm but an ordinary man, it's the times that have made me." Well, I don't think he really believed he was an ordinary man, and he certainly wasn't an ordinary man. But they knew that they had been born in exciting times, serious times, as Adams said.
Mm-hmm. It's remarkable. How does the son of a colonial Braintree shoemaker become so motivated and able enough to fill this role?
Well, that's a very, very good question. And there's so many misconceptions about John Adams, And one of them is that he's thought to have been a rich Boston blue blood. Well, he wasn't any of those things. He wasn't rich, and he wasn't a Bostonian, and he wasn't a blue blood. He was, as you say, a shoemaker and farmer son. He grew up as a New Englander in a rural town on a farm, knowing from childhood that life wasn't easy. Life was a battle, a struggle, that nothing came without effort, and you had to earn your place in life. He also is, in my view, one of the best examples I know of in our history of the transforming effect of education. His mother was almost certainly illiterate. His father, we know, could sign his name, but we really don't know if he could do much more than that. And the boy showed exceptional ability and great promise at a very early age. The father saw that. And the father was determined that the boy was going to go to college, and went so far as to sell 10 acres of land, which was absolutely against the father's whole concept of how you went about life. You never sold land. Land was the only true wealth. But he sold 10 acres to help pay the cost of sending the boy to college. And young John Adams himself won a partial scholarship. So he went off to Harvard, which was nothing like the Harvard of the present day. It was a small academy, really, with a faculty of about seven and four buildings, and students came at age 15. It was really almost like a high school, but it was the best there was to be had in the country. And at Harvard, John Adams discovered books, as he said, and as he also said, from that point on, I read forever. And he became, I think, the most broadly and deeply read American of that very bookish time, more so even than Jefferson. He never stopped reading. He never stopped learning. And he understood that learning, and they many of them felt that learning was part of the pursuit of happiness. When those people of that time wrote of the pursuit of happiness, as Jefferson expressed it in the Declaration of Independence, they weren't talking about material affluence or ease or long vacations. Nobody ever heard of a vacation then. They were talking about an enlargement of the experience of being alive through learning and the life of the spirit, the life of the mind and the spirit. And again and again, what they all were saying, and especially eloquently, Jefferson and Adams and Franklin, was the importance of education. If you want one strong, sustaining theme all through our story as a people, one consistent ideal, it is the ideal of education. And they felt this especially because they were convinced that the system wasn't going to work, the system of government of the people, of self-governing, of a self-governing population. The system wouldn't work unless people were educated. Jefferson said it wonderfully in a single sentence. He said, any nation that expects to be ignorant and free expects what never was and never can be. And that was bedrock faith. And both of those men lived that life. And one of the great pleasures and inspirations that comes from reading their letters, particularly in their years of retirement, the letters back and forth to each other from Quincy, Massachusetts, and Monticello, is their continuing interest as old men in the life of the mind, in what they were reading, in education, philosophy, history, Greek, Latin, and so forth. In other words, education wasn't something you just did for a while you were a youngster. It went on all through life.
And this was borne out by the words that they committed to paper in articulating the principles of the new nation.
Indeed, and Adams was the author of the oldest written constitution still in use anywhere in the world today, which is the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, which predates our national constitution by a full decade. And it provides the essential structure of government that we have in our national constitution. But there's a paragraph in that Constitution of Massachusetts which was unlike anything that had ever been set forth before, in which he says it shall be the duty of the government to educate everybody. Now, we take that for granted, but that was radical in that day. And when he wrote it, he was sure that the legislature of Massachusetts would strike that out, that they wouldn't vote for it. Well, in fact, they did vote for it, and furthermore, they voted for it unanimously. And that was a major event in the rise of popular or public education. And again, something of the kind that we should never, ever take for granted.
We're talking this morning with David McCullough. He is the author of John Adams, which won the Pulitzer Prize when it was published last year in hardcover. It was recently issued in paperback by Touchstone Books. As author of many other books, he's twice won the Pulitzer Prize, in fact, once for his book on Truman. Your questions, if you would like to join us, are welcome around Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. We do have a listener waiting in Aurora on line number 4. Let's include this person. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. Hi. Good morning. Very happy to hear this program. I wanted to ask, the country was so new. Where did these people have an income or a daily income to do the things they did? You spoke of him selling land to put his son through college, but initially, where did he get the money to buy the land? I never hear about income.
Well, they were farmers, and they were tradesmen or craftsmen, shoemakers, blacksmiths, sailors, merchants, so forth. And the Adams family arrived in Massachusetts in the 17th century, the 1630s.
Oh, and way back then.
Way back then. John Adams was fourth-generation American.
Oh.
And but his income came from their farm. And his income, after he returned to Massachusetts from the presidency, after he and Abigail left the White House, their income came from their farm. That's what they survived on. The remarkable thing is that he was not only willing, John Adams, willing to serve his country for years and years at really very modest financial reward, and left his wife Abigail with a tremendous responsibility of not only raising their children and looking after their education and the rest, but running the farm, making ends meet, which was extremely difficult for her.
I would suppose so. That's why I asked the question.
Yes, yeah. And money as we know it was cash money, was a very rare thing. So an awful lot of what was done by barter.
Yes.
So that you would trade, and she set up a little business where he, if he were in Philadelphia or were in Europe, would buy and send her everyday items like handkerchiefs and pins and things of that sort, which she would then sell. She was running her own mail order business, as we might say,
mm-hmm.
Through the war. Abigail Adams is, in my view, one of the most admirable of all Americans. She was as profound, as staunch a patriot as any of the men. She suffered the absence of her husband for years, 10 years altogether. And when he would get down and begin to think that he was spending too much time away from home and it was costing too much to aggravation and anxiety, worrying about his family and being separated from her, she would write back and tell him, you're doing what really matters and you stay with it. This is what we have to do. And one of the very poignant lines in her letters is, I wonder if future generations will ever know what we have suffered in their behalf. And sadly, the answer is no, we don't. And we do live in difficult, dangerous, and uncertain times. But believe me, they lived in far more dangerous and uncertain times than we do. And life, just everyday life without a revolutionary war, without all the privations of shortages and inflation and so forth during a revolutionary war, just ordinary life was far more difficult, far more filled far more with inconveniences and discomforts and fears than we ever have to even think about. The fear of epidemic disease,
sure.
For example. The smallpox in particular, epidemic dysentery did sweep through those small farming towns of Massachusetts and elsewhere and take the lives of hundreds of people in a matter of weeks. For a woman like Abigail Adams, she would have to be up at 5 o'clock in the morning, get the fire started for breakfast, wake up the hired girl, wake up the children. With her husband away, she had to tend the stock. She made the clothes for the family. She educated them, her children, herself, because the schools were closed during the war at home. She had a day as full and as hard, hard work as one could imagine. And yet, she had the motivation and the stamina to sit down at her kitchen table at 10 o'clock with the house quiet, all the children asleep, and with the light of a candle take up her pen and write to her husband some of the most marvelous letters ever written by an American. And those letters have survived. They're still to be seen, still to be held in your own hands in the Massachusetts Historical Society in Boston.
We have another call to talk with. I promise I'll get right to, but since we're talking about Abigail, I think it's worth talking a little bit more about the extraordinary relationship they had, the very deep friendship and romance and very very strong commitment and support they had for each other. And in fact, it's probably, he probably couldn't have done near what he did without her, not just as a support, but as an intellectual companion.
Well, she and their affection, their respect, their dependence on each other are at the very center of his story. You cannot understand him and what he did without understanding her and her part in their lives. She was the daughter of a clergyman, a minister, and as a consequence grew up in a rather different atmosphere than her husband. There were books in the house. Her father was a man of importance in the community. And though she never went to school, she was only educated at home. She was a voracious reader all of her life, and an irrepressible writer. And she was, I think, having spent years reading what she wrote, and the letters, by the way, number in the thousands, I think she was incapable of writing a dull sentence. It isn't just that she was the wife of a president and the mother of a president, and thus the first woman in our history to ever play that dual role, and the only one up until President Bush, George W. Bush, became president, mm-hmm. and now Barbara Bush, his mother, can claim that same part in our history. But had she been the wife of someone of no consequence, had Abigail Adams just been a New England housewife and written the letters she wrote, we would need to know about her, because the letters are far, far more in number and far more consequential in quality than the letters of almost any other woman of that time.
We're a little past our midpoint with David McCullough talking about his book, John Adams, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and talking about the remarkable life and times of John Adams and the dawn of American independence. We have one caller waiting to join our conversation. If you would like to also, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. And also by email, you can send us a note, talk@wyll.uiuc.edu. We have a listener in Charleston next on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, I'm assuming that this question is pertinent based on Mr. McCullough's wide knowledge and understanding of constitutional and historical entities. My question is, how do you account for today's void between rich and poor worldwide, and can it be fixed? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Well, that's a very large and extremely important question. I was walking, I'm in Washington for a few days, and I was walking along the street yesterday, and I saw a lineup of people waiting to get food. A soup kitchen, as they used to be called, was set up in one of the little parks just within blocks of some of the finest hotels and the White House and so forth. And I was asking myself that same question. What can we do? What is the explanation for this? And I don't know that I can answer it, or that anyone can. And one could say, thus it's ever been. And it is true, thus it's ever been. But if we can set to rights so much else about life, if we can solve so many very complicated and difficult problems, to use the old saying, if we can put a man on the moon and so forth, why can't we solve this? And I think we've all got to ask ourselves that question and really think hard about it.
Hope that gets to the question. We have, our lines are all full, in fact, now. Let's go on and talk with some more listeners. Next up, someone in Chicago on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, hello. First, I want to thank Mr. McCullough for a wonderful book. But also, I guess my question is about our history as a freedom-loving people. The Constitution, especially the writ of habeas corpus, seems to be very much threatened at this point. And when you look back over our history, it seems whenever Americans feel physically or is threatened as far as their security, we trample on the Constitution and the way we imprisoned the Japanese during American citizens during World War II and what's happening now. And I guess, what did John Adams, did Thomas Jefferson foresee what a frightened people we would be and how we could protect our Constitution? I mean, it seems like we're always in a situation where we're waving the flag and spitting on the Constitution at the same time.
Well, not always. We've done that when it seemed to be times of emergency, when the country was threatened and when we were in danger. Now, it's easy and perhaps accurate to say that we have often overreacted. I think probably the most glaring example was the idea that we put over 100,000 Japanese Americans, 80% of whom, more than 80% of whom were citizens, in those camps during World War II. Lincoln dismissed habeas corpus during the Civil War, and no one really knows how many people were held in jail. Estimates range from 3,000 to as much as 30,000 people by the time the war had ended. Adams himself, who believed fervently in an open government, he said, we must have an open government. We must know what's being said and done. He himself signed the Sedition Act, which made it illegal, unlawful to say derogatory or defamatory things about members of the government. And I think some 25 or 30 people were tried by juries, an open trial, and they went to jail for that. But it was clearly a violation of the First Amendment, freedom of speech. But in all of these cases, it was because we were at war or threatened by war and threatened by internal danger from spies, zealots, fifth column, as they used to say, violence, and terrorists. And while it looks particularly un-American in retrospect, and often looked un-American to many people at the time,
right.
It didn't seem that was quite so when the threat was hanging over everyone's head. I think one thing to take into consideration, too, is that every time such a crisis has passed, we have gone immediately back to our fundamental way of conducting ourselves, gone back to the Constitution. There are some times when certain liberties have to be curtailed or limited in order to protect ourselves, to protect the lives and the safety of our citizens. And they are very difficult decisions to make, and there's no question that these decisions ought to be subjects of discussion, debate, consideration, and as much as we can remain an open society, we certainly should do so.
We have several calls to talk with, and also an email question from a listener. I'll read that quickly and ask you to maybe address dealing with the letters from Jefferson to Adams. The question is, weren't the letters from Jefferson to Adams and vice versa a social event? They were read out loud to the family after the evening meal and discussed. Did this knowledge of a larger audience improve the quality of the letter? That's the question from someone who writes.
That's a very interesting thought. Yes, they undoubtedly were read out loud. Certainly Jefferson's letters were passed around or read out loud among the what remained of Adams' family by that time. People read out loud to one another far more than we do now, and I think something has been lost in family life and in the enjoyment of writing and prose and poetry. And writers wrote to be read out loud. People would sit in the evening, someone would in a parlor would read a book out loud, while others might have been knitting or shelling peas or whatever. And in the spirit of communication and understanding of the beauty of the language, this was often a far better way than just reading it in isolation, particularly with poetry. And of course, the 18th century produced some of the greatest poets of all time. And John and Abigail Adams were avid readers of Alexander Pope and Milton and the poems of Daniel Defoe, people like that, and of course Samuel Johnson. So yes, what was written, what was published, very often was read out loud and expected to be read out loud.
If we have time, I'd like to follow up on that, but we have several callers waiting, and I will defer to them. We have someone next on line number two from Mahomet High School. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Morning. I'm a first-time caller, a long-time listener. And we were wondering what, his biggest decision was in as his presidency.
Well, I think that in my view, and he himself felt that the biggest decision he made as president was to use all of his influence, power of his office, to keep this country from going to war with France. We were at war at sea, an unofficial war at sea, And there was a great clamor, a great popular demand to go to war with France all out. And Adams very skillfully negotiated, navigated those treacherous waters, and succeeded in keeping the country from going to war. And had we gone to war, let me say, it would have been almost certainly a disastrous experience for us, because we would have gone to war with Napoleon. And we were very poorly prepared for anything like a war, just financially. We couldn't have paid for it to begin with. And had we gone to war with Napoleon, it seems reasonable to assume, there's very little likelihood that Napoleon would have been willing to bring about anything like the Louisiana Purchase. So while it cost Adams considerably in the political way, almost certainly prevented his re-election, he did the right thing. And he once said that if it were anything to be put on his tombstone, that he'd like to say he kept us out of a war with France.
Caller, want to follow up?
No, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call. He also was really the founder of the Navy.
He was the founder of the Navy. He was the founder of the Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. He was the man who, by the force of argument and his determination on the floor of Congress, drove the Declaration of Independence through the Congress, got the Congress to vote for it, which was no small achievement, because it was touch and go whether they would vote for it. Very close. He is the one who insisted that, proposed on the floor of the Congress, that George Washington be put in command of the Continental Army. He's the one that insisted that Jefferson be the one to write the Declaration of Independence. He is the president who put John Marshall on the Supreme Court, which, just as a casting director, if you will, he was extraordinary. And he wrote some of the most vivid and solid political statements of political belief, philosophy, creed. He was our first ambassador to the Court of St. James's after the Revolutionary War was over. And he was the one who, on his own, went to the Netherlands and got the Dutch bankers to lend us the United States, which hadn't been recognized, hadn't won its independence yet, to get the Dutch to really provide the financial wherewithal with which to fight the Revolutionary War, which may be as important as almost anything he ever did, because we were desperate for money to pay for the war and for the Dutch to help supply arms. John Adams never failed to answer the call of his country to serve. And no matter what season of the year, no matter how inconvenient for him, no matter what sacrifice it would call for on his part to give up his private life, his professional life, in order to serve the country. He's a great example of public service in the best sense.
He also seems to have played a key role in getting France to intervene in the Revolutionary War, so that eventually...
He did indeed, yeah. And that was all important. And I think this is of utmost... very revealing about him as a human being. He was the only one of the founding fathers who never owned a slave as a matter of principle. And if anything, I think it's fair to say that his wife Abigail was even more adamant on the subject of slavery.
I certainly would love to talk about that a little bit more, because there's much more there. There are a couple callers waiting, though, and I want to make sure we include them in our conversation. We'll go next to a listener in Bloomington, Indiana, on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I heard your comments on John Adams and the rest of our founding fathers' views of education. Would you comment on a couple of very brief quotations about education from our founding fathers. The first quotation comes from our Northwest Ordinance. By the way, the Northwest Ordinance is very important to Illinois because Illinois came into the Union by complying with the Northwest Ordinance. And here's what the Northwest Ordinance says in Article 3. Religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. That's from the Northwest Ordinance. Now from our Constitutional Convention, a man who was very active, Gouverneur Morris, in our Constitutional Convention. This is what Gouverneur Morris said at our Constitutional Convention. Religion is the only solid basis of good morals. Therefore, education should teach the precepts of religion and the duties of man toward God. Noah Webster, the same Noah Webster that wrote the dictionary, was also a delegate to our Constitutional Convention. He worked with Gouverneur Morris. He wrote part of the Constitution. Here's what Noah Webster said. The Christian religion is the most important and one of the first things in which all children under a free government ought to be instructed. What are your comments, sir?
Well, I think that it's been a failing on the part of many historians, and I would include myself, too, that we haven't paid sufficient attention to the importance of religion and religious thought and religious belief in the course of American history. We believe very strongly that in the separation of church and state, and rightly so. But it would be a mistake to assume that there was a separation between church and statesman. Now, Adams was a deeply religious man. He was a devout Christian all of his life, a man who... I don't know that he ever missed a Sunday without going to church, and he often went several times on the single Sunday. However, when he wrote his paragraph in the Constitution of Massachusetts about it being the duty of the government to educate everybody, he talked about the need to educate young people in science and literature and agriculture and natural history, and it went on for a long list. He did not include religion. I really think he felt that that was not part of the processes of education. If he did so, he never said so specifically that I know of.
He also took a very strong stand, especially later in his life, about religious tolerance.
He certainly did, particularly about... religious tolerance all through the country. There's a wonderful scene when he first arrived in Philadelphia, and he'd never been near a Catholic church before, and he attended Mass at a Catholic church in Philadelphia, which is still there, same church, and he stayed for the whole Mass, which lasted some 2 hours. And afterward, he wrote a marvelous letter to Abigail describing everything about the service and the priest and the altar and so forth. At the end of it, he said that he found the service both moving and awful. And a number of people who've read that, students and some scholars or historians, have said that he, there as a New England Protestant of with a Puritan background, was very narrow-minded about this Catholic service, to call it awful. Well, that's a misunderstanding of the fact that in the 18th century, many words had different meanings from what they do today. And one of them was the word awful. It didn't mean awful as we use it. It meant full of awe or awesome. So he has an open mind about it. He's interested in all religions. As a delegate to the Continental Congress, every Sunday he would go to a different church just to hear the service, to listen to the minister. It's a very interesting part of his own education.
We have just about 3 minutes left with our guest, David McCullough, and we have a couple of callers. I want to try to squeeze in at least one more, and this is, again, from Mohammed Seymour High School. In the interest of education, let's talk with them. Line number two. Good morning.
Hi.
Yes.
I would like for you to discuss the relations between Adams and Ben Franklin.
Okay.
It's a very interesting relationship. Adams was a great admirer of Franklin, as everybody in America was. We must keep in mind that Benjamin Franklin was the most famous American alive, both in this country and abroad. And the regard for him was enormous. Farmers, for example, all thought highly of Benjamin Franklin, if for no other reason than he invented the lightning rod, right, which, of course, saved many a barn and many a house from going up in flames. Adams had read what Franklin had written, and Adams appreciated Franklin's humor and Franklin's kind of wry wisdom. And he enjoyed working with him in the Continental Congress. However, and he never lost his respect for Franklin's ability and Franklin's wit and Franklin's importance. But when Adams arrived in France to assist Franklin, to work with Franklin in negotiations with the French to get them to come in on our side during the war and supply us with arms and ultimately military force, he found that Franklin's, by his lights, was lazy and sort of sloppy and, in Adams' view, not running a very good ship. And that, in part, as Adams acknowledged, was because Franklin was old and he was really beyond past his prime and ill much of the time. So while I think he greatly admired Franklin and never lost a sight of Franklin's importance as an American figure, He found working with him extremely frustrating at that stage.
We just have a minute left. I'm sorry to say there's much more we could talk about that we're just not going to be able to get to. I wondered if you could say, you know, just a brief word about the sort of controversial nature of John Adams. Many people thought he was very conceited and vain, and it wasn't necessarily an easy person for a lot of people to work with, and yet he was still very effective.
Well, he could be cranky and abrasive and quick-tempered, and he was fiercely independent, which was both his strength and in some ways a disadvantage. He was honest to almost to a fault. He could be tactless in that respect. But anyone who got to know him, as Jefferson wrote, as well as anybody, to know him was to love him, to understand his extraordinary integrity and courage. And it was the courage of his convictions. He was besides, and I think this is important to emphasize, he was brilliant. He was one of the most brilliant men ever in public life in this country. And fortunately, he was there at the beginning, at the founding time, much to our advantage.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. And I will, though, suggest for folks who'd like to know more about the story of John Adams, look for the book, John Adams, by our guest during this hour, David McCullough. The book won the Pulitzer Prize. It is now out in paper by Touchstone Books, and I'm sure you can find it in libraries and bookstores. And to you, David McCullough, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for including me in your program.
All right. Best to you.